together, if we can, from 2 Corinthians chapter 4, just to get us going. And we'll read from verse 1 of 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Just while you look it up, let me explain what we're going to do tonight. We're going to divide this meeting into roughly three bits. We're talking, as you know, about reaching young people, about the whole problem of evangelism of young people. And I think there are three issues that you need to think about very, very clearly indeed if you're going to tackle this problem. The first is, why young people as a class anyway? What is special about them? What makes them different and marks them out from other groups that makes us need to think about evangelism to young people as a separate kind of activity? And then second, I think you have to think about, well, what methods do you use for reaching young people? What is the job? What does it actually entail? And then third, I want to say a bit about what have been called the kids in the cracks, the ones we don't notice. The number of young people in this country who are completely outside the sphere of any Christian influence whatsoever and remain so because we have no programs whatsoever for reaching them. So I want to talk about those three things, and I want to do it in as involving a way as possible. I want to speak for a few minutes about each topic and then throw it open for any comments, questions, suggestions, whatever from you. Because when we had the first meeting of this kind, the one on teaching young people earlier on this week, it was valuable that people had a chance to come back and discuss and talk, because quite clearly we had then, and I guess have in this room now, more experience in youth work and more collective wisdom from years of involvement with young people than I personally possess. And it's good if we're able to share the accumulated wisdom of people who've served the Lord in this way down through years. But anyway, let's read these verses together from 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and then we'll get into the first part of that. Therefore, says Paul, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Rather, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not use deception, nor do we distort the word of God. On the contrary, by setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we do not preach ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. That's all we'll read for the moment. This must be one of those passages that just about every evangelist returns to again and again, because rarely in the scriptures do you find such a concentrated exposition of the attitude and the motivation that you need in presenting the gospel to men and women of whatever age. It sounds a lot of notes that we need to remind ourselves of in any form of evangelism, and especially perhaps in evangelism amongst young people. For instance, the fact that our gospel has got to be an honest gospel. We've renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not distort the word of God. We've got to have a message which is intellectually honest. The temptation in youth work very often is to cut corners, isn't it? To simplify things. To use a verse to preach a dramatic sermon, which doesn't really mean what we make it mean, but it sounds good at the time. To rely on the fact that young people are naive and don't understand very much yet, to fob them off with easy answers, when really we know that the issue we're dealing with is much more complicated. We can't do that. We have renounced shameful, underhanded ways. We have to give people the truth with plain dealing. On the contrary, says Paul, by setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves. And that's the second thing. The truth has to be plain. We have to have a gospel of clarity as well. We have to get the message across in terms that people can understand. And very often, I think, when teenagers have been judged by Christians to be rejecting the message, it's simply that they haven't heard it. I well remember how, for example, we had a school mission in Swindon, in one school in which the whole theme of the week was being born again and explaining what the Bible meant by that particular phrase. And right through the week, we were teaching people things in a very, very simple way about that. Well, at the end of the week, about 20 of them had made some kind of a commitment, and they came down to our church to the evening service. And nobody had told the preacher, but he preached about being born again. And he was saying virtually the same things that we'd been teaching in lessons and assemblies and evening coffee bars right through the week. But the way he was presenting it, although it was exactly the same facts that they'd heard, made them come out of the service looking puzzled, saying, "We didn't understand a word of that." Now, if they had been non-Christians, we could easily have said, well, they heard the gospel and they rejected it. Actually, they just hadn't understood it in the way it was being presented. And I learned a lesson that night, that very often the things we do and the styles which have become familiar to us just do not communicate. There is more of a cultural gap than we sometimes realize. And we have to make every effort to set forth the truth plainly. And then Paul says, we commend ourselves to every man's conscience. That's another thing about the gospel, isn't it? The gospel isn't just the gospel of a happy life. The gospel of satisfied existence. The gospel challenges people's consciences. It's sin and righteousness and judgment that the Holy Spirit uses as the means of conviction in someone's heart. And therefore we have to have a gospel that deals honestly with the human situation. And it's easy to present a gospel to young people which stuns them with glamour. First we put on a testimony from George Best's sister-in-law's husband's uncle's milkman. Then we put on a rock group to deafen them for 5 minutes. Lights and flashing things and glamour. And then a preacher stands up and in 5 minutes of jokes and emotional appeals says, come to the front and give your life to Jesus. And the young people have got no idea what they are being manipulated to do. I've seen all too much evangelism like that. I've been involved in the mission. I say involved in the mission. It was nothing to do with me. I was just on the fringes of it. Where in 2 nights at the end of the mission, on the first night, 125 young people came to be counselled. And on the second night, 150 came to be counselled. And the organisers were beside themselves. This was revival breaking out in the Birmingham area. Went back to the same town about 6 months later. There were maybe 15 of them left. The others were not just non-Christian again, they were thoroughly anti-Christian because they'd been badly burned and they didn't want anything to do with it anymore. We commend ourselves to every man's conscience. We make them clear of the issues we're actually dealing with. And then Paul goes on to say, we do not preach ourselves but Jesus Christ as Lord and ourselves as your servants. For Christ's sake. Those two things belong together. You cannot preach Jesus Christ as Lord without preaching yourself as a servant at the same time. If the two parts are not there, the one part will not carry any conviction to the people who hear your message. Unless they see the servant heart in you, they will not respond to what you claim about someone they've never seen. And that's especially true, I think, in young people's work. Because youth evangelism is not something that is easy. It's easy to gain a crowd. It's easy to sway them. It's easy to manipulate them to the point of decision. It is not easy to see Christ formed in a young person's life. It takes tears and sweat and struggle. And one of the things I often say on youth leaders' training days, and I believe older Christians need to hear this too, is that being a youth leader can be the toughest job in the whole church. Because on the one hand, you're dealing with people who have the demanding nature of children. They've just grown up beyond childhood, and they still engross a lot of your time when you're an adult. And young people, let's face it, are not children in the sense that they don't go to bed at children's bedtimes, so they can knock on your door at inconvenient times. And they demand a lot of your attention, and they suck a lot of the stamina and the drive out of you if you're not careful. On the other hand, they're like adults in that their lives have become as complicated as the lives of adults. They have all the social complexity, all the different relationships that adults do have. And so young people give you the disadvantages of children and the disadvantages of adults. They can be the most complicated specimens in the whole church to be dealing with. And the youth leader can have a tough job. Now, I know that all too often, historically, in our brethren assemblies, we have given the job of youth leader to some young man or young couple on their way up, and we think that if they cut their teeth on an easy job like that for a few years, then they can go into something adult. I tell you, youth leader is one of the toughest jobs you can give anybody, especially in today's world. So, what we want to do is look at some of the areas they're involved in the evangelism of young people, and allow you to come back at some of the things I'm saying every so often. One of the things that strikes you straight away when you start looking at the situation of this country at the moment is that evangelism of young people is something we are not doing very well. The majority of young people in this country are not really that interested in Jesus Christ. And many more of them than 20 years ago have heard about him, because there is more evangelism amongst young people going on than there was 20 years ago. When I go into schools now, I don't find the same sort of blank ignorance that there was even 10 years back. I find more people who've got Christian friends, more people who've been, perhaps even just for a short time, to Christian meetings of some kind. They have some kind of basic awareness. The whole born-again movement and the fuss that that's created in the newspapers coming across from America has focused some people's attention on what it means to be a Christian. Christians in the news like Cliff Richard and U2 and various people like that have made some people sit up and think, so there really are people who are Christians. And there's a bit more acquaintance with the Christian faith than there was. But for all that, the majority of young people I meet have written off Christianity as a live option for their lives. And we need to think about why this is and what we can do to reverse the trend. The first question I suggested that we needed to ask was, okay, what is special about young people? Does it make sense to talk about youth evangelism as if it's a separate category from children's evangelism or adult evangelism or old folks evangelism? Is there anything different about teenagers that makes it sensible to talk about them as a separate category? I think there are half a dozen things. I'm not sure I'll mention all six of them, but here are one or two anyway, just from the top. The first thing is that obviously young people are at a stage of intellectual and moral growth which makes them unusual. They're at a stage when they're passing from being children, the last stage of their childhood, the junior stage, which is characterized by people having very clear moral certainties about what's right and what's wrong, and by being unable really to think too clearly in terms of abstract ideas. And they're passing from that stage into a stage where they start to think in terms of abstract things. And concepts like honesty and truth and right and wrong come to mean a little bit more, and they can juggle these things about mentally and make more sophisticated judgments. And morally, they're losing some of the certainties that they had when they were children. They're losing some of their dependence on authority. Nobody can be more self-righteous or more a friend of the teacher than the child who's 9, 10 or 11. Authority is desperately important at that stage of your life. And then all of a sudden you start standing back and looking at authorities and saying, well, says you, do I need to think that way? What do I think myself? And young people are at the stage where they're starting to form opinions for themselves. Now that's got implications for our evangelism of them. They are neither children anymore, nor are they fully formed adults yet. And a temptation in our evangelism is to treat them either as children or as adults. Either we treat them as children, in which case we lecture them, we tell them what they ought to think, we cut off their questions, and we administer the truth to them in a dogmatic fashion, which I don't think is the biblical way. We said the other night that children and young people are addressed rather differently by the Bible. Children are just told to obey their parents and respect authority. Young people are appealed to. Look at Proverbs, look at Ecclesiastes, look at some of the Psalms. The young man has a choice before him. He's standing facing two ways. He can go the right way or the wrong way. And he has to choose for himself whether or not he will follow his father's instruction, whether or not he will listen to the commands of his mother. He has to choose for himself. But he's not an adult yet who's chosen the way of wisdom. He's still in that fluctuating state in between. And often we treat young people as children and don't give them the psychological space in which to come to their own conclusions about things. And we try to make the decisions for them and shield them from the world out there. You know, I think biblically the world is not out there. We forget that the world is also in here. And you can keep them away from expressions of the world out there and never deal with the world in here. And it's easy for us to put them into a little mold of our own making while they're early teenagers and hope that we're going to keep them away from evil influences so that they grow up to be just like us. They may grow up, if they succumb, to be clones of ours, but they won't have any life, any individuality, any independence of their own. And if we want them to be mature Christian adults who can stand on their own feet, we need to educate them to the point where they can make their own decisions and then give them the freedom to do so. But they're not adults either. And sometimes our evangelism of them treats them as if they were adults and browbeats them emotionally and expects them to make decisions in a way that adults would make decisions. I'll say a bit more about this in a minute, but I think applying emotional pressure to a young person to decide for Christ can be a very dangerous thing to do and can lead him and us into a situation of total unreality. I'll talk more about that in a moment. So we have to respect the stage they're at and deal with them sensitively. And that means that flash-bang-wallop means of evangelism, trying to do everything in 24 hours, is not going to work. Involvement with a young person's life in an ongoing way is going to be absolutely necessary if you're going to guide him through that troublesome period from the end of childhood to the start of adulthood and introduce him to Jesus Christ on the way. It cannot be done in a hurry. The second thing is that because young people are in this fluctuating state where they're just sorting out who they are, they're very keen to find something to belong to, something that will give them certainty and a fixed marker in their lives. And let's face it, for most young people, what that means is romance. That's the easy way to do it. And that's why you see carved on school desks all across the country, Tracy and Jason together forever. And they're looking for permanence, they're looking for solidity, they're looking for something to define themselves by and belong to. And you know how long teenage romances tend to last. So you have this phenomenon that kids are good at committing themselves to things, but not good at making it work. They'll go into a relationship saying, this is it, she's wonderful, she's tremendous, this is the one I'm going to marry. Oh, we're going to run away next week. How old are you? 13? Never mind. It's going to be great. And then the week later they're saying, well, I don't know what I ever saw in her, really. I've met her little sister now, it's changed my mind a little bit. And so you have to be careful with the commitments that young people make. It's easy for a young person to say, I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back. And then to have changed his mind the following Wednesday. I mentioned earlier in the week a book by Mark Ashton, which has just come out, a book called Christian Youth Work, published by Kingsway, which I commend to you. It's got a very sensitive chapter on evangelism amongst teenagers. And he says in that chapter, look, sometimes you get in a situation where a 14-year-old girl comes with tears in her eyes to accept Christ. And if you're a wise youth worker, you will not accept that at face value. You'll probe, you'll be sensitive and you'll be gentle, but you'll try to work out what's going on there. It could be just that she's only just split up with her very first boyfriend. And in the emotional rebound, she's looking for something else to give her solidity, and she fastens on to Jesus. But next week, when she's met somebody else with dark hair and flashing eyes, she'll be off in the other direction. And you have to be careful, because it is so easy for young people to get hooked into a spurious decision that they don't really mean. It doesn't mean that there's no reality there whatsoever, but it does mean that that decision needs to be taken care of and sheltered and nurtured sensitively so that what is real in it will start to blossom and grow, and you won't be hooking too much of your expectations into something which may not be all that real. So you have to be very careful. Conversion is going to be a delicate long-term job. Some youth workers I know talk in terms of a four-year conversion. The fact that over a period of 4 years somewhere they have seen young people become Christians, and only God knows the exact moment. The young person may think it happened at a certain moment when he walked forward or raised his hand in the air or asked to speak to the speaker at the end of a meeting or something like that. It may have been then, it may not. Only God knows the precise moment. But somewhere within that 4 year period that the youth worker was working with him, he passed from darkness to light. And it doesn't matter where it was in that period. The point is that it took that long for the decision to make sense in terms of an adult, mature commitment to Jesus Christ. Then the third thing about young people is that they're volatile. They're emotionally up and down in the air. They can change emotionally with bewildering rapidity. I used to be in a Christian music group that went around schools playing concerts in various places. And we were awful, we were really dreadful, but kids seemed to like it. And hundreds of them would come along in the evening and get quite excited about the kind of music we were playing. It'd be a hubbub of conversation and people doing all sorts of silly things, and we'd play the music. And sometimes the organisers would get very worried about it. And at the interval they'd say, look, these kids are too excited, you're never going to be able to preach to them at the end. They're getting too fizzed up, you're working them up. It's no good, you'll have to stop, you'll have to cool down. Otherwise we're going to have a riot on our hands. Shall we call the police now or later? You know, and we'd say, well, now, Don't worry, we've seen this situation before, because it happens all the time. Don't worry. And they'd never believe us. They'd go on worrying and biting their fingernails. But at the end of the evening, because we had given people a good time, they could be leaping about and making all sorts of wild noises in one song, and then we'd say at the end of the song, OK, we want you to sit down on the floor for about 15 minutes. We've got some things to say to you. And they'd sit down like lambs, and you could hear a pin drop. And people would respond to Christ and mean it at the end of that. And the switch was just bewildering to see. And it's easy to be fooled by that when you're a youth leader. You have a communion service on a youth weekend or something like that, which is absolutely amazing. The sensitivity, the depth, the sheer naked emotion as they worship the Lord brings tears to your eyes, and you think, oh, these kids, they're really getting there. They're starting to love Jesus. It's fantastic. And then 2 minutes after it's over, they're kicking a ball about outside and fooling about and throwing a girl in the showers and doing all sorts of stupid things. You're like, ah, is that all it meant to them? Oh, no, it meant an awful lot more. It's just that the emotional switch has gone on. They can only handle so much of one extreme, and so they switch to the other to relieve themselves. Now, what that means, if young people are like that, is that evangelism that bases itself on young people's emotions is in for a hard time. And if you rely on working them up emotionally to the point where they say, yes, yes, I will, I want to become a Christian, you are liable to get a decision which will let you down, because as soon as the emotional switch goes on, they'll desert it. And I think that's why so often we have youth missions which seem to produce such good results and leave such impressive statistics on the evangelist prayer letter. But the people who actually live in the situation know that after the evangelist packed his bag and moved on, there's precious little left behind. Then, young people, we have to remember, are the inheritors of our culture. They're growing up to an age where they are starting to appreciate all of the things that our culture gives them. The entertainment, the media, the means of leisure and relaxation that we have around for them. And nobody is more enthusiastic about it than people who've just got it. And we're living in a culture which celebrates the big and the flashy and the glamorous and the spectacular. And it's all too much of a temptation sometimes to focus our evangelism in that kind of a way. And just think that if we do something big and stunning enough, they'll come flocking in droves, mesmerized by the glamour of the gospel, and give themselves to Jesus Christ. That was not the way in which the early church did its evangelism. And I think there's a place for the big event. I think there's a place for things like rock music and drama and so on and so forth. I'll say a little bit more about that later on. I won't defend the theology of it tonight. That is another argument completely. But I'll say what I think the place of those things might be if you accept that they are biblically acceptable things. But I think if you base your evangelism around those things and rely on those to make people impressed and make them become Christians, you are heading for failure. Because they'll be impressed by the big events. And then when you send them into something smaller and something less impressive, they won't be impressed. Kids can easily become impressed by the glamour of microphones and loud noises and things like that and say, yes, if this is what Christianity is about, rush me some. I'll have it. Yes, I'll buy a slice. And then when you find that next Sunday you're expected to go to a church service, which, well, where are the lights? Where are the microphones? Who is that old bloke preaching up there? It's a completely different world. It's easy for kids to feel we've been conned. They gave us an image, a flashy image, which doesn't reflect in what they want us to get involved with now. Jesus said that you need to count the cost of following him. And all too often, we try to put a false surface over Christianity in the way we do youth evangelism. Hey kids, come to Jesus. It's the latest in thing. Look who's become a Christian this week. Such and such a rock star, such and such a football player. Hey, everybody's becoming a Christian. Why don't you? You'll be left out if you don't. That is not the way to do youth evangelism. None of us would say those things, but often the methods we would use imply them. Then you've got to remember too, and this is the final one that I'll come up with, that young people are more responsive to others of their own age than any other age group in society. They're absolutely paranoid about what other kids think of them. Peer pressure is a very, very important factor. Nobody likes to be the one that stands out against the crowd. And kids will do anything to be accepted by the group. Now, what that means, well, it means a lot of things. Let me just mention three. The first thing is that it means that being different is one of the costs that a young person will have to pay when he or she becomes a Christian. And therefore, I found as a preacher, it's something that needs to be mentioned. If they are really genuinely going to count the cost, then you've got to warn them. Now look, if you do become a Christian, you're going to have to stand out against the crowd. Your friends may misunderstand you. They may think you've gone all holy. They may not be so friendly with you anymore. You may find yourself in situations where you think, well, why did I start on this business? I've got no friends left. And you may find you have to identify with other people whom naturally you wouldn't be friends with. People whom you previously thought were a bit wet and not quite your scene. But if Jesus Christ is real and if Jesus Christ is alive, then that's part of the cost of becoming a Christian. And I think unless we let people see quite clearly what they're coming into, then they will find, when they do enter our circles, that there's a part of the cost we haven't told them about, and they'll feel they've been cheated, and they'll desert us. Second thing that this peer pressure issue means, I think, is that young people can be the best evangelists of young people. Because young people communicate very effectively to other young people, it means that they are the best evangelists we've got. And whenever I go into a school to do a mission with a Christian Union group that's there, one of the things I say to them over and over before it starts is, now look, this is not my mission. This is your mission. I'm just the catalyst. I'm the guy who's going to come in and make a disturbance and get everybody talking and thinking about Jesus. You are the ones that they will talk to. And time and again that happens. At the end of an evening coffee bar, I will preach. And you sense that people are hanging on to your every word and they really want to know. And then you say, okay, you want to know some more afterwards? Come and talk to me. Or if you don't want to talk to me, you can talk to one of the people here whom you know who is a Christian. And they've been listening and looking at you and drinking in every word so much that you expect a queue to form up to talk to you afterwards. And they don't. They go and talk to other young Christians the same shape and size as themselves. Why? Because I'm the religious expert. I'm a Christian and I get paid for doing it. I'm a professional. So if they come to me with a stupid question, I might draw myself up to my full height and just say something absolutely crushing and they won't have any way of getting back at me. Whereas if they go to somebody who's the same age and size and shape as themselves and they ask a stupid question and he says, oh, that was a stupid question, they can at least dot him one. They're safer. They feel on safer ground with somebody like themselves. And therefore, when you've got teenagers who are geared up to sharing the faith with somebody else, you have got a workforce second to none. I can't evangelize teenagers. All I can do is be an agent for teenagers to evangelize their peers. And I think all too often we make that mistake in the youth groups that we're on, that we expect to do the evangelism, whereas it's the young people who really do it. We tend to organize the events. We say, right, we'll put on something for your friends. Now, kids, bring your friends along. And we expect them just to do that, to bring their friends to things. They can do far more than that. And if anything's to get through to their friends, they must do more than that. And we've got to take them seriously as evangelists. I'm always concerned about the way in which when there is a mission coming off in an area, when an evangelist is moving in to hold some meetings, there are some counselling classes arranged, and every youth leader within a certain radius sends his group along to the counselling classes to learn how to do it, to reach people for Christ. And for a couple of weeks before the mission, they get all fizzed up about it and they learn all of these techniques and gimmicks and methods for doing it, and they go out and witness frantically to their friends, and then after that it all fades away. I don't think we should wait for a special event like that to train our young people in how to evangelize. We should do it to them when there's nothing very special going on. We should train them to do it as part of their ongoing lifestyle. It should be an accepted part of being a young Christian in our youth groups that they are clued up and able to talk to their friends when their friends ask questions of them. After all, always be ready with a reason for the hope that's in you is something that applies to young Christians as well as to older ones. And then the third thing about this peer pressure thing, I'm going to grind to a halt here and let you come back at me for a few minutes, is that because young people look at one another and determine their lives by what one another think, that means that there are changes in adolescent society from time to time. Teenagers today are not the same thing as teenagers in the 1960s. They do not think the same way. I mean, certain things never change. It's always possible to raise a cheap laugh if you're doing a youth worker's training day by quoting the letter of Peter the Hermit from way back in the 12th century, in which he talked about, I don't know what these young people nowadays are coming to. They cheat their fathers, they go around and they stay out all night and they do this and they do, I don't know what young people are coming to. And obviously that hasn't changed over 700 years. Young people are in some ways always the same. But there can be changes in youth culture which, if we want to evangelize them effectively, we need to take note of. They can be fairly subtle things. For example, Lawrence Richards, who is a writer for young people in America, wrote a series of books in the 1960s under the title Youth Asks. They've just been republished in the 80s under the title Answers for Youth. And that's a cultural change. The 60s was the age of letting it all hang out, asking questions, being creative, stating your case, letting people know what you thought. In the 80s, people are more reticent. They don't want to say things. They want to hear things. They don't want to make a change in the world, make an impression upon it. They want the world to give it things. We've got much more of a consumer mentality. Young people have changed a little bit, and the wise youth evangelist will realise that. All too often, people who try to evangelise young people have the sketchiest idea of where young people are at. For example, and those of you who read Harvester will have to pardon this illustration because I've used it at least twice in Harvester over the last 2 years. I remember one spring harvest when I was put in charge of the youth work, and that year they decided on the suicidal policy of having a different great man come in every day, one of those speakers from the main programme, to talk to the young people. So you had five or six great men one day after another, with no sort of coordination with one another, each coming in to say their bit to the young people. And every single one of them chose to talk about sex, because clearly they all thought that that was all young people thought about all the time. And they thought they were being relevant and getting to the heart of teenagers' needs and really saying things that these teenagers needed to hear. Well, they listened politely, but at the end of the week we asked them to fill in a reaction sheet to let us know what they thought of the programme that had been arranged for them. And on sheet after sheet we got the response coming back, why did all those men talk about sex all the time? It wasn't really that absorbing to them. People had made a false assumption about where they actually were. Don Posterski, who works for a youth organisation in Canada, said in an article recently, many of today's teens are saying that they'd rather experience intimacy, a sense of belonging in their own cluster of relationships, than be a leader in an organisation or formalised group. Today's youth have already taken out membership by becoming a member of a small cluster group. The dynamics there are demanding. They have to give priority to this friendship relationship. So their first interest is taken up. Their time is committed. This appears to be a change from the 1960s. I'll say it's a change from the 1960s. You don't no longer find it so easy to find Christian young people who want to be leaders, who want to be out there doing something with initiative, doing something for Jesus. Now the small group of friends matters an awful lot more. And if it's a choice between going out to a meeting or going somewhere with your friends will likely win. Because the small cluster, the small network of people who are your immediate social circle are much more important than they were 20 years ago. Those are changes in the dynamics of the way that young people have been thinking. And if we want to evangelize them successfully, we need to realize those things are going on. Okay, that's the first thing. Those are some of the things which make young people different and mean that we have to think seriously about the ways in which we evangelise them, because it's a more complicated job than it may appear at first sight. Now, let me stop for a moment and throw it open to you to come back with any comments or suggestions or questions, if you like, because I haven't been all that clear, I realise that, that you want to come back at me with. Okay, over to you.
Statement you made 6,000 words ago.
Sorry. I'm trying to get a lot of stuff in.
Try and bring the thing in as well. Mm. You made a statement, something that speaking to the young people, Jesus wasn't that relevant in their lives. Mm. And then you went on to say, just after that, that in fact, the young people know more about Jesus today than they did, say, 10 years ago. Mm. Just wonder where those two statements stand up.
Right. What I meant by that was simply that, say, back 10, 15 years ago, a lot of young people didn't know and didn't care about Christianity, but they'd rejected Christianity completely from a position of ignorance. Now, I think today I'm meeting many more young people who understand at least the rudiments of the gospel. They've maybe heard it in a Sunday school somewhere. They've maybe had it shared with them by a Christian friend. They've maybe heard Cliff Richard's testimony over the radio or something like that. But they understand at least something about the cross and something about the kind of new life which Jesus is offering. They're clear about the fact that being a Christian is not simply a matter of being a church attender, but they're still not interested. They see the claim, they don't see the reality.
Can you explain why this should be?
How long have you got? I think partly it comes down to the fact that Christian young people are not presenting the kind of convincing Christian life to their contemporaries that they ought to be presenting. I meet school after school where the Christian kids are accused of being the most wet, the most immature, the least grown up in the school. And sadly, in many cases, that's true. They are not young people whom the others admire. And sometimes that's because they've been brought up in a kind of atmosphere where they have not been given much freedom to think things through for themselves and come to their own decisions. They have simply accepted a very strict authoritarianism, and therefore they are not maturing as fast as their contemporaries. I think that's part of it. There are other reasons too. I think part of it too is that young people look at the church and they're not impressed the way the church functions. Even evangelical churches very often seem to be way behind the times, speaking a language they don't understand and holding services which are of absolutely no interest to them. There are all kinds of things. But it's unnerving that people can actually hear the gospel and understand some of the scheme without feeling any compulsion to respond to it. Okay, let's go on then, shall we? Because I think people are maybe a bit embarrassed to sort of say too much at this point. Fair enough. I will be around anyway over coffee at the end to be shot down in flames, so please feel free to do so. And don't feel either that the next two bits are going to be quite as long as that one was, because that obviously is a foundational one. I'll be a lot shorter on the next two things I want to say. The second thing I want to say then is this. If that's what young people are like, if those are some of the issues that you have to take on board, what does the job of evangelizing young people actually involve? And I want to say that I think there are basically three things that you have to do in order to present the gospel to young people in a way which they can respond to biblically and properly. And that's, first of all, making an impression on them. Second, discipling them to the point where they can understand the implications of the gospel for their own life. And third, finding a moment where you really challenge them to a decision. And I think all three of those elements are important. Let's look at them one after another just for a few minutes here. The first thing is that you need to make an impression. I think the reason that a lot of people never really come up against Christianity in a form which makes them think about it seriously as an option for themselves is because they're not impressed by it. That's what we've just been talking about. And young people today, let's face it, are obsessed with style, as they never have been before. The clothes you wear have got to have the right designer labels on. The image you project is all important. In the record market now, it's not just the records. They don't just sell on their sound alone. You have to have a good video to go with it, because if the video is rubbish on top of the pops, then the record's never going to sell. The look, the image, the style, that's what's desperately important. And if you buy a magazine like Smash Hits, which gives you the words of pop songs, and look at it, I know some of you have never done that in your life, but do it sometime because it might be interesting, you'll find that lots of the lyrics of today's pop songs don't make sense. They don't say anything. They project a sort of feel, a kind of image. They conjure up a picture. A song like Wild Boys, for instance, which was one of the big hits of a short while ago, it paints a picture of sort of something vaguely Neanderthal and prehistoric and cavemen and wild people going about hitting one another over the head and things like that. But it doesn't say anything. It's all a mood, a pose, an image. And young people are obsessed by what things look like. Now, very often, I think our youth evangelism falls down because it's not of the best. Giving people invitations to a coffee bar that you've printed on black-edged card because you got them cheap from a printing works that didn't need them anymore is not going to impress many people. Organising something in the school hall, which happens at lunchtime, but you're running around for 10 minutes trying to start it with 200 people already sitting in the hall while you're trying to change plugs and make the amplifier work and so on, is not impressing people. What we do in youth evangelism needs to be crisp and slick and professional in order to make an impact. And this is where I think big events have their place. I was in a music group, as I say, and we were playing the most awful kind of rock and roll. And Christians often said to me, do you really believe, can you really believe that rock and roll is a fitting medium for presenting the gospel? And I used to say, no, I don't believe rock and roll can present the gospel. That happens through what we say. That happens through the personal contacts. But rock and roll is a tremendous megaphone for getting people to listen. I don't know any other way that you can get 300 people into a school hall just like that. I don't know any other way that you can get so much respect and attention as you stand there talking about the reality of Jesus Christ than when you've got a guitar strung round your neck and you're standing at a microphone doing it. I can preach and use all sorts of preacher's tricks in order to ram home my message to young people, but it's so much easier when I'm using that kind of method that appeals to them and just makes them sit up and pay attention. The method doesn't convert them. It's no way of taking people all the way to the kingdom of God, but it can make an impression which is important and valuable. And I think a lot of young people are never exposed to the gospel simply because we don't do anything which is loud and vociferous enough to make them sit up and pay attention. And I think very often the people who do put on big events expect them to do too much. You cannot hold a concert and bring lots of kids along who have never heard the gospel before and sing a string of songs which are basically unconnected with one another and mumble a few words in between about thank you very much and the next song tells about and so on, and expect people to have pieced together in their head by the end of the evening what the gospel is, what its implications are, and what they ought to do about it. And even if you do put on a fiery preacher for 10 minutes who challenges young people and tears at their heartstrings and invites them to come forward, you are not going to get serious commitments to Christ coming out of that kind of atmosphere. Your concert may be a megaphone that draws people's attention to the gospel, starts them on the first step of a journey towards Jesus Christ, but it's not going to do the job in one. And if you expect it to, you're going to be disappointed. So making an impression is vital and it's important, but it's all that some methods will do. You need to go on from there. And that's where the second job comes in. And the second job I think we've got is to get young people to the point where they understand the implications of the gospel. They're discipled into following Jesus, if you like. Because I think today, young people especially have got preconceptions about what Christianity is that it's very difficult to blast through. Sometimes it takes a long time for people to digest what is really being offered to them. They may have, as we were saying a few minutes ago, a surface knowledge of the gospel, but they haven't really taken on board what Calvary means. They haven't really understood what's meant by a new life and what the breathtaking possibilities that Jesus Christ is holding out to them actually are. And it can take a long time for that to get through. I well remember spending 4 years teaching religious education in one school in Swindon. I did it on a sort of 2 days a week basis as part of my evangelistic work, because if I wasn't doing it, there would be no RE in that particular school. And I remember sitting in my classroom one lunch hour. I used to sit there because the kids went to and fro through it, and it was a good way of talking to them. And one sixth form girl whom I'd taught for 2 years came up and started chatting to me. And I had taught her class, as I say, one period a week for 2 years. And I'd striven to the best of my ability, straining every nerve, to get across what the gospel of Jesus Christ was. I'd invited other people into the school, the most impressive guests, people who had trusted Jesus and gone through all sorts of suffering as a result, people who had the most tremendous way of articulating their faith. It had all been showered on this class, and Jane was standing there and she was saying to me, you know, I think what I don't like about Christianity is basically it's a bribe system. I said, what do you mean? She said, you know, I mean, it's, basically you live a good life, and if you're good enough, then, you know, God, the old man in the sky, likes you and pats you on the back and lets you into heaven. I mean, that's basically it, isn't it? I said, Jane, you're stupid. She didn't like that because she was a sixth year. I said, where have you been for the last 2 years? You haven't heard a word I've been saying. And now you have a bright girl who went on to take four A-levels and she went off to university. I don't know what she's doing now. But through 2 years of RE, and she'd sat up and paid attention and done homework for me and all the rest of it, she had not got the basic point that I'd been trying to get across week after week after week. I think sometimes we fail to understand just how big a barrier people have got in their thinking as to what the gospel actually is. Now, that means that sometimes you cannot rush people into commitment. You need to take a long time before people really understand what the gospel is all about. And one thing that we've done in our own schoolwork, I've got a copy of the book on at the back there, you can see it afterwards if you like, is that we found that going into a school for a week, taking lessons and assemblies, telling people about Jesus, answering their questions as we met them in the corridor, doing lunchtime events, doing coffee bars in the evening, all of that talk and all of that exposition and all of that teaching wasn't enough to get people to the point in 5 days where they understood enough to accept Jesus Christ. There was a saying in the Mission England training a few years ago that most people in Britain today need to hear the gospel at least 5 times before they're ready to accept it. But with most school kids I know, it goes a lot longer than that. And we were finding that at the end of the week, if we held a final concert and said, okay, kids, if you want to become a Christian, we want to give you the chance tonight. You can decide. You go with Jesus or you leave him. Heaven or hell. Your decision. Make your decision now. We would find that we would get maybe 20 people who would make a decision and maybe 5 of them would stick. And we always felt that was not right. That was not evangelism. That was not the way it should be done. And so we decided to invent a method whereby people could discover a little bit more before they came to the point of commitment. And we invented a technique which we called just looking. And basically what it involved was training the young people who were there in the school, who were Christians already, to run a group for their friends, a group that wouldn't need much expertise or theological skill to lead, but a group which would meet over 5 weeks, in which there would be 5 non-Christians and 1 Christian, and in which those 5 non-Christians would gradually study the Bible and learn what a Christian was. They'd be exposed to some of the basic evidence for the Christian faith. They'd meet 3 Christians who would come to the group to share their testimony and answer any questions that they wanted. They'd be taken to a church service just once. And at the end of all of that process, if they decided to walk away and say, no thanks, I'm not interested, nobody would make them feel that they'd done something dreadful. It was a chance to look at Christianity with no strings attached. The Christians, it was explained, would be doing everything they could to recommend Jesus to them. But the decision would be theirs. No pressure would be placed on them. They wouldn't be bored. Now we find, if we go through a week challenging people not to decide for Christ on the spot, but to sign up for a just looking group, many more of them will sign up than would ever come into a counselling room. And of the 50 or 60 who sign up, you will find that 75%, on the figures I have at the moment, at the end of that 5 weeks, will have somewhere along the way trusted Jesus Christ, and they will stick. My friend who does schools work with me was in a school in Stockport recently, just a couple of weeks ago, where he was trying to explain this just looking concept to people in the church there who were behind the mission. And they were saying, well, I don't know, does it really work? Is it worth doing? And there were a few Christians working readily, won't feel at all embarrassed by turning up in church, but will never go any further. It's a funny thing, it's not so out of fashion as it was even 10 years ago now to be seen going into a church on a Sunday morning. It's quite a good thing to do. And they'll come to the mother and toddler groups, and they'll come to the luncheon clubs, and they'll do this and they'll do that. But as for going any further, although you preach at them and you present the gospel faithfully, they won't. Because being laid back, not being too committed, is what life's all about. And Christopher Lash, in his book, The Culture of Narcissism, says this is something about modern life. So many people are out to get us, get our money, get our vote, get our soul, that the way we survive in life is by what he calls ironic detachment. You try not to get too involved. So when the Reader's Digest send you an envelope that says, you have just won 5 chances to win £80,000, you say, ah, yes, sure, and you put it straight in the bin, carefully removing the 5p inside the envelope before you do so. And you shy away from anything that's trying to get you. And Lash says this, as more and more people find themselves working at jobs that are in fact beneath their abilities, as leisure and sociability themselves take on the qualities of work, the posture of cynical detachment becomes the dominant style of everyday life. And he says, the upshot is that the disparity between romance and reality, the world of the beautiful people you see on television in Dallas and things like that, and the workaday world, gives rise to an ironic detachment that dulls pain, but also cripples the will to change your life, to change social conditions, to make even modest improvements in work and play, and to restore meaning and dignity to everyday life. And lots of people are living in this kind of ironic detachment thing. They don't want to get too committed to anything. They want to stand on the fringes and enjoy the consumer benefits without plumping for everything that's involved. And young people, particularly the inheritors of our culture, can be caught in that. And therefore, I think it's important to build into your evangelism program with young people chances for them to decide. This is something that Just Looking tries to do, incidentally. Every week, at the end of every group session, there's a section in the book headed Finally Over to You, which gives them a multiple choice quiz which they have to fill in, which makes it clear to them exactly where they've got to. I think that what I've heard this week is a load of rubbish. What I've heard this week makes sense to me, but I'm not convinced yet. What I've heard this week leaves me with no other alternative but to become a Christian. And they have to take things like that week by week and make up their mind exactly where they now stand. And I think responsible youth evangelism is constantly challenging young people and saying, where do you stand now? How are you moving? Are you coming closer to Jesus? Are you going further away? Are you at the point where you're going to follow Jesus? Have you taken it on board yet? Have you got the courage? Have you got the nerve? Where are you? And while we don't manipulate people and we don't stun them with emotion, still, we keep on giving them chances to decide and press the importance of decision upon them, because it's the third job that we have to do. And that's why house parties, weekends away, and things like that can be desperately important in youth work, because they give people a chance to go out of their own situation. And when you're in a strange environment, it's easier to see your life in perspective and think about it objectively and think, well, I could go this way, I could go this way. Which way am I going? Helps people decide. It's why it's good to take groups of young people out to other evangelistic events in other places, because often hearing the gospel in that kind of environment, it will come across with a freshness that it doesn't in the week-by-week sort of grind of the youth group, and it will give them a chance to commit themselves once and for all. And those are basic things, but it's part of youth evangelism. We neglect any part of that at our peril. We need to make the impression. We need to teach in a discipling kind of a way. And third, we need to challenge to commitment. Miss out any one of those things and your youth evangelism is not going to work. Okay, now, I have a few things to say about the kids in the cracks, the ones we normally miss, and that'll take us up to the finishing point. But before I do that and just say my last few words, let me throw it open to you once again for anything you want to come back with arising out of what I've just said. I certainly think that if young people are going to become Christians, they're going to have to meet the church sooner or later. And the problem of a lot of evangelism that's done amongst teenagers is that it stresses the importance of Jesus and underplays the church. There are a lot of youth evangelists I know who talk about the church in an attempt to sort of gain identification with the young people. They say, oh, we know that, you know that the church is deadly boring and it's full of old vicars who are talking rubbish and, you know, people singing out of hymn books that were written 400 years ago. And you know the church is dying desperate, but Jesus is wonderful. And that is not a way to recommend the gospel. Because if people are coming into the kingdom of God, they are coming into the family of God as well. And so they need to be involved with the church. And so there is no reason why church services should not be a means of young people becoming Christians. And one thing that's, I think, been a spin-off of older people finding it less embarrassing to come back to church has been that more and more teenagers that you wouldn't expect to are also turning up in church across the country. And going to a church service on a Sunday is not necessarily such a no-no thing to do as it was back in the 60s. It's possible now for a teenager to be invited along to a church service and go without too much embarrassment. But that does mean, as I think your question implies, that what he finds when he gets there has got to make sense. And that doesn't mean it's got to be trendy and zingy and the preacher's got to dress in denim and all of the songs have got to be up-to-date choruses or anything like that. Because I think if anyone is going to join the church, he's got to take the church on its own terms too. And he's got to be prepared to accept Jesus' analysis of human life, which means that no one age group is all important. I think sometimes youth services give the wrong impression. Sometimes we bend over backwards in the direction of teenagers so much that we're almost saying what their own culture says. Youth is the all-important thing. We're prepared to change our whole church and do everything just to make you feel at home. You come in here and we make it a teenage place for you. They don't want that. They want reality. They want a family in which every age group has its place, everyone matters, and in which they feel warm and secure and wanted. And so you'll find that teenagers who find they are welcome in a church will put up with an awful lot of things which culturally are just not them. I know an Anglican church in England where they have services run by the young people once a month. And it's quite funny because the young people, when they sit down to plan the services, always say, oh, well, I suppose we better stick in a couple of psalms because we hate them. But the old people like them. And the old people, on the other hand, always come along to the youth services because they say, well, we hate the things they do, but the young people like it. And they've got exactly the right attitude to one another. A bit of give and take in which they're learning together and in which young people are becoming Christians in the services. Now, that kind of thing can happen. And I don't see why it shouldn't.
Could I ask you, after what you've just said, where does that all fit in to the rock concert? And where is this dividing line between the rock scene with this very strong satanic influence and the gospel of Jesus Christ? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm saying that, I'm genuinely asking a bit, I'm one of the old boys who I find it very difficult to actually see rock and the gospel together. I find it very difficult. And I have four children, and obviously I'm going to have to get used to all this.
Right, I think, yes, a full-scale exposition of how I believe rock music fits into evangelism would take a long time, so you'll excuse me just for saying a few things very briefly. I think any kind of music is just a medium which can be used for good or for ill. It's a sequence of notes, it's a rhythm, and it can be used for any purpose, good or bad. I don't find the arguments of that book, Pop Goes the Gospel, at all convincing. And I say that, though the three authors are all friends of mine. I think that what they say about the structure of rock music, the fact that they've got this repetitive beat, musical phrases played with over and over again, could describe many other kinds of music as well. In fact, one fellow who was trained at the Royal Academy of Music had a look at that chapter of the book and said, well, what they're describing there is a perfect description of a Vivaldi concerto, which I think is interesting. I think music is neutral. You can use it for good or for ill. You have to be careful how you use a form which has been associated very often with sexual excess, with drugs, and with, as you say, satanic influence of one kind or another. But that does not mean it's totally beyond use. I know Christian poets. Now, about the turn of the 20th century, symbolist poetry in France was tied up with Satanism and the occult in just the same way that rock music was in the 1960s. Artists were using Satanism and exploration into magic as a way of enhancing their art, and in a very dangerous way, perhaps. Nonetheless, that doesn't mean that all poetry is satanic and poetry is not a medium for Christian truth. And what convinced me, I think, that rock music was a valuable means to use in youth evangelism was seeing it used and using it myself. I mean, Blanchard, Cleave and Anderson in that book about rock music say, show me one person who is in a Bible college today or out on the mission field who is there because of rock music. Well, as I said, first of all, that's the wrong question to ask because rock music is an introduction to the gospel. It's not something that takes you all the way. But secondly, I could point you to people today who are out on the mission field who I know, who became Christians through rock concerts, or who were drawn to Christ initially through the witness of a Christian rock group. And the results are there. And I think what I have seen convinces me that you can use the medium if you're careful, if you're sensitive that you're not emotionally manipulating people or doing anything you shouldn't or leaving the wrong impressions, to have a tremendous influence for God. What you associate with rock music, from what you see on Top of the Pops or the Tube or whatever, is not necessarily exhausting all the potential of the medium. And there's an awful lot that can be done with it other than what is you see on the media. And I think that's really all that one can say. Yeah. Okay, let me give you my 5 minutes worth on the kids and the cracks, because I think this is desperately important and something that needs to be said just to round it off. All I have said so far, and I know I've said an awful lot, but all I have said so far could be fitted into the kind of youth work that most churches are doing anyway. And I think we have to face the fact sooner or later in the evangelical church in Great Britain that the style of work that we do amongst young people misses out a large proportion of the youth population. Frontier Youth Trust often says that 95% of Christian youth work in Britain is done amongst 5% of the youth population. And I think that's true if you look at the results we achieve. We are happy with middle-class kids who are heading for O-levels and hires, possibly university. We are happy with kids who are being brought up to save money and be responsible and have haircuts and things like that. We are not so good with working class kids. We're not so good with the unemployed. We are hopeless with the ethnic minorities. We are missing out on a tremendous number of young people in this country. And often it's because we just do not notice that they are there. There's a fellow called Jim Peterson who works for the Navigators in America, and he's written a book called Evangelism as a Lifestyle, which, again, I very much commend to you. And he says in that book, which is a very perceptive book, that from his research, 90% of the church's evangelism is done amongst the 50% of the population who have some contact with the churches. There is another 50% out there in Scotland who have no contact with the churches, and by and large, we're not reaching them. The people who become Christians, the people we do our work amongst, are the people who are on the fringe of the church anyway. And there are more and more people out there who are what Peterson calls secularized, whom we say nothing to and who do not even understand what we're trying to say to them. Peterson talks about the fact that we are left surrounded by a secularized world, a world we are so accustomed to that we are scarcely aware it exists. We are not effectively communicating with secularized men and women. How do people become secularized? Well, he says this. Those who have become secularized have made a transition from a religious philosophy to a non-religious one. A few may have made this transition within their own lifetime. More often, the transition involves several generations of disillusionment with religion. Many of these people are at least a generation removed from experiencing life within a religious framework. They feel that religion has been exhausted as a valid basis for a personal philosophy. They are post-religious. In other words, they are people who've been brought up in an atmosphere in which mum and dad didn't go to church. And as far back as the family can remember, grandfather didn't go to church either. And so they are families which have grown away from Christian influence and into whose minds the idea of being anything involved with the church just never comes. And they are all over Scotland. And some families have been that way since the Industrial Revolution. You can trace it back through history. Even as far back as 1854, Horace Mann, who did some work on the people who actually went to churches, noted how absolutely insignificant a proportion of the congregation is composed of artisans. In other words, even in those days, the church was middle class. When Moody and Sankey came to Scotland in the 1870s, they reached thousands, and they were all middle class. The working population was not reached much. Even Spurgeon, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, who reached thousands in a working class area of London, realised that most of his congregation came from the middle class areas round about. They just came in on a Sunday and then went straight out again. And he said that the working men of Walworth were breaking his heart. He said, "We all feel that a hardening process is going on among the masses. Those who attend church or chapel are marked men. It's not the thing to do in a working class community." Now, often we find that working class people will send their kids to our Sunday schools much more than the middle class will. It's easy to get working class kids in your Sunday school because working class mums and dads think it's a good thing for the kids to do. But as soon as they become teenagers, they tend to leave us because it's not the thing to do in working class life to go on into adult church membership. So all of a sudden they're not there anymore and we're left with the middle class kids who've stuck. And it's a big problem. I don't pretend to have the answers to it. All I'm doing tonight really is pointing out a need, a fact that that's there. And I think it's important that we, particularly in brethren circles, think about this. Because our whole history in Scotland was a history of making an impact on working class communities and leading people to Christ that the other churches were not touching. That was what the early days of the Brethren movement right across central Scotland and in the northeast was all about. And I think the fact that we have become a middle-class successful movement is one of the most limiting things about us. It means there are all sorts of young people that we cannot reach anymore. My father, many of you know him, works in prisons, in Inglenochill Detention Centre. He has young men who are wide open to the gospel in a way in which young people from their home environments very rarely are. It's because they've been shaken up. They've been put through a prison system which is harsh and brutal and makes them think, where am I going? What is my life for? And many of them in the Bible class in Glenochill make a decision to trust Christ. And the headache he has had for almost 20 years now has been, what on earth do you do with them afterwards? Because it's so difficult to send new life back into our assemblies. And the difficulty is the class division. These are kids in the cracks. Kids that by and large we don't see and we don't work with. And when they come to our door, we don't know how to handle. It's not that we don't want them, it's just that we don't know how to keep them. And so they go away again. And so what I'm saying is this, if you are satisfied in your assembly with a kind of youth work which runs a little Bible class or a little YPF or a little Covenanter group or whatever and attracts basically the children of church families plus a few like-minded friends, you are settling for less than the challenge of youth work in Scotland today presents you with. There are lots of kids you will never meet and they will grow up into godless adults. And what that means, it seems to me, is that some of us need to look at our youth work and not be content with what we're achieving and see if we can't redistribute our resources and do something different so that we meet those young people who are growing up way outside the sphere of our influence and become able to minister to them in one way or another. There are no easy answers. It's a hard, tough job. There's another book, if I dare mention another book tonight, called Gutter Feelings, written by a friend of mine called Pip Wilson, who worked in the Mayflower Family Centre in London for some years, and now is in Romford YMCA doing a similar job amongst the kids that the churches generally aren't interested in. And he talks very honestly in that book about the heartbreak of the whole thing, how difficult it is, and how little the churches want to know about that kind of young person. And yet the creepy thing to me as a youth evangelist in this country is that that kind of young person is increasing in numbers right across the face of the country. The catchment area of youth with whom we traditionally do well is shrinking and shrinking. And by and large, the evangelical church isn't that bothered. I simply mention that because it's an important area we need to think about. Something we mustn't lose sight of when we think about youth evangelism. It's important to meet those, to minister to those who are the children of church families. Of course it is. We have a special responsibility to them. And their friends are going to be the first that come along, obviously, naturally. And so we have a natural inroad into ministry to them. And we mustn't neglect that. But we've got to reach the others. They need Christ just like everybody else. And if we're ignoring them and ignoring their need, then we're not doing youth evangelism as the Master wants us to. A lot of ideas there, a lot of things to think about. Let's just pray together, shall we? Father, I'm very conscious that we've skated over the surface of many different important subjects tonight, and very superficially. And I just pray that it won't have been too bewildering. I'm conscious that I haven't done it very well. I pray just that What is important for us to remember? What gives us direction from here on in? What gives us insight and understanding into youth work will stick with us, and you will not let it go. Some of us are involved directly, and Father, we pray for them. Those who are working on the interface between the church and the youth population. Those who are trying to present Jesus Christ honestly and straightforwardly. Jesus as Lord, themselves as your servants, to young people in Scotland today. We all pray for them. And for those of us who are not directly involved in youth work, Father, we simply pray that from tonight we'll take away a little bit more insight into the job that the youth workers in our church are facing, so that we can pray for them, we can dream dreams for them, we can plan for them, we can make resources available to them, and together we can see the youth population of our town and our area confronted challengingly and effectively with the reality of Jesus Christ, so that lives become transformed, your church grows, and your kingdom is extended. We ask this, Lord, not for our own satisfaction, nor even for their eternal security, important as that is, but simply so that your glory may be seen in Scotland in 1987. And we ask it for your name's sake. Amen.